So what did we do on Friday? So on Friday, we learned about linear optics quantum computing, which is a model of quantum computation where we have optical element, phase shifters and beam splitters, single photon source, and detectors which can detect between 0, 1, and 2 photons. If it detects more, great for you, but it doesn't have to do more in that particular scheme that I explained on Friday. And I showed you that with this, we can make gates which are not unitary. They are probabilistic. They work sometime. Sometimes they fail. But you know when they work and fail. And that knowledge helps you to build a blueprint for a quantum computer where you can use these gates in conjunction with teleportation and transfer the difficulty of making a gate to the difficulty of making a state, which is quite different. Because if you have a state preparation which fails, and you can check that it fails before you make it interact with your quantum information, then you can stop, try again, and make this happen. So with this, we put all of this together, and I showed you how to do this. And if the quantum teleportation in linear optics would work at 100%, that would have been very easy, but it didn't. But I showed you how to improve the teleportation so that it succeeds better and better and better, up to a small epsilon. And then I raised my hand and I said, in week 3, you'll learn about quantum interaction, which will take care of the small epsilon. So that was the third optics proposal that I mentioned to you in the last week. And then that was the end of this lecture. Today, we'll talk about NMR, but now I look at Aggie looking at me and kind of raise a light bulb in my head. She's put on the Dropbox a list of gates that I talked about last week. Somebody, one of you asked about having a list of these gates. So she's put this on the Dropbox so you can just go and have a look at it. And then in the tutorial Dropbox. So you can find it there. And we were wondering if this was the answer to the question that one of you asked. If it is not, then ask again and we'll provide the answer so that you can understand things. Okay, so what we're going to do today is switch modality for quantum information. And we'll talk about nuclear magnetic resonance. And then I'll finish about electron spin or magnetic resonance as a complement to this. But this is a well-defined proposal, and I'll show you the different steps of how to, again, build a quantum processor. It'll be a bit different than the linear optics. Linear optics, in some sense, was very abstract and kind of making a lot of different circuits and in a very abstract way to do something. You'll see that this one is very much hands-on, and I hope by the end of the lecture you'll be there with your fingers and trying to figure out how these pins work. And there's a joke in the field that we've gone to about a dozen quantum bits, or let's say 10 quantum bits with the system. And the reason is that people have only 10 fingers. Maybe if somebody with imagination can use their toes, then maybe you can go up to 20. And then, but you'll see a little bit in a few minutes what I'm will be talking about. I'll first give you what are the qubits, what does an NMR spectrometer does, in a very kind of high-level way, but enough to give you a little bit of intuition, the details. I'll first, and then I'll mention about the initial state, just point out a bit how it works, but I'll come back at the end of this lecture and say, how can we improve these initial state? I'll talk about what is the measurement, and then I'll talk about gates, one-qubit gates, two-qubit gates, back to an initial state, and if I'm going kind of at a good pace enough, then we'll think about one idea of an implementation of a small quantum algorithm, and totally at random, I might pick quantum teleportation to give you. As by the end of these 3 weeks, you'll have heard quantum teleportation in many different contexts, and it's one which is, I think, very neat. So let's start about what are the qubits. So in nuclear magnetic resonance, it's the we build our qubits out of the magnetic moment of the nucleus of certain atoms. So if we have an atom of hydrogen,
or carbon.
Okay. Right. Now, I have a joke. So I'm going to start with a different molecule. Let's say we have a molecule with a carbon like this. 3-chlorine. And if you remember a little bit of your chemistry, hydrogen has a magnetic moment. It's a spin half. So it behaves like a little magnet. And what we're going to think about is if the magnets point up, it's a zero. The magnet point down, it's a one. And by now, you know that it can point in different direction on the Bloch sphere, and that will be the superposition of my state. When I do this, I use something which is not really correct of pointing where the spin is doing in three space and associated at the same time as the Bloch sphere. The Bloch sphere is really the space of these operator or end states. And when I say the magnet is pointing it, I say where does the magnetic moment point out? So I confound these two things. But once you know that I associate these two things, we can move on. So if you look at other atoms we could use, we can think about carbon. But if you look at carbon, there's different isotope. Carbon 12 doesn't have a magnetic moment, useless. But there's an isotope which is called carbon 13, and then you can use it because it does have a spin half. There's other atoms like chlorine has a spin 3 half. And it turns out that in this molecule, the spin 3 half pieces interact incredibly weakly with the spin half. So you can pretty much forget about them. It's like you cannot totally forget about them because if they interact very weakly, they lead to decoherence. But once you know this, then you can say if the decoherence is weak enough, then at least we can use this. So anybody knows what is this molecule? That's it. So it's chloroform. And the joke is I didn't put this to make you fall asleep on a Monday morning. So this would be a 2-qubit quantum processor. So the idea is to use the spin which is here and the spin which is there as one qubit. We'll look at another molecule. Again, some chlorine in there. And this is called trichloroethylene. So that trichlorine, one hydrogen, two carbons. And again, we'll have 3 qubits in this case here. When you look at this, your first reaction is, OK, we're going to act on this when we're going to make gates. We act on this when we make gates. And then we can send a pulse here or pulse there in physical space to distinguish between the two. But unfortunately, we cannot do that. And the reason is goes down of how do we interact with these pins. We interact with the magnetic field. And we will see in a few minutes that to start the initial state, we have to put these molecules on a very strong magnetic field to get to a state which looks like e to the minus beta h, where this is the hydrogen, this is the Hamiltonian. So be sure you don't mix these two H that I'm talking about here. And the Hamiltonian is the magnetic moment times B. The magnetic moment is some constant. Okay, the proton will have a magnetic moment. And if I look at my notes, it's something like 26.75, 10 to the 7 per Tesla second. Okay, so the magnetic moment is mu times the Pauli operator sigma. And if we have a spin half, they're really the 2 by 2 matrices. B is the magnetic field. And then, as I mentioned, and we'll see this a little bit, to make set up the initial state, we take a magnetic field and we make it in the z direction. So we build a spectrometer, which is made a very strong magnet. So we'll have a sample of these molecules inside a big cavity with some liquid helium, some air, and some liquid nitrogen. And in the liquid helium, we'll have some
niobium,
wires, and we put current in these wire to produce a magnetic field. We're going to call it B0 in the direction Z, and we assume that Z is upward on the blackboard. Okay. We put about 100 amps of current in these wires.
Just a question. Picture is a bit confusing. Are you sure you mean the dots in that row? Or...
So this thing is about big like this, okay? And there's a couple of, there is one container inside of the other. So the first one is the one with the liquid helium. We need the liquid helium so that niobium is superconducting. And we want this superconducting. So when we put current, there is no resistance. If there's no resistance, once you've put the current, then it remains there and you have a nearly constant magnetic field. If you put 100 amps of current, you get a magnetic field which goes to about 10 to the 15 Tesla. Okay? Amount of energy in there is about a stick of dynamite. So once you go from your magnet, which is warm, you cool it down, you put the current, and if somebody comes in and shake this thing so that these helium wire comes out, these niobium wire comes out of the helium, you'll have a runaway reaction because this is going to warm up a little bit. If it warms up, it makes the helium boil. The helium boils, it doesn't keep this being turned, and then the energy turns into heat, and then a small boom happens. So you have to be really careful when you fill this of helium and also of nitrogen so that this thing doesn't shake too much. Okay? So then you produce this big magnetic field in the system. So I hope my artistic talent gives you an idea of what this thing is. And stop me again. I know very well what it looks like.
It's still not clear whether are the dots supposed to be in the same container.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, it has a spherical symmetry. Oh, it's one of these Escher. Now I understand. I thought we were going to go in the seventh dimension to do our quantum computation. So there's a container indeed. The wire is kind of wrapped this way. You put current to this thing. And when there's this current, you close the switch. And it's pretty amazing. You have this. And if you keep putting liquid helium and nitrogen, this thing is going to, years and years, that it's the current is going in there. So it's very neat technology. You have the liquid nitrogen on the outside because it's much cheaper to pay for liquid nitrogen than liquid helium. So it insulates it a little bit. Yeah. So if you have about 10 Tesla, and then you have this magnetic moment, then you get that omega, which is this magnetic moment times this field divided by kT at room temperature of about 10 to the minus 5. So if you go and look at the initial state, e to the minus beta h, beta times h is, or the constant in front of this is very, very small. And then so the initial state, I'll come back why it is. So we have the z operator here because b will be mostly, at least the static part is in the z direction. So b times the Pauli matrices picks up the z direction. And then all the constant that comes in is the mu times the value of b0. And here I assume that h bar is equal to 1, but you have a very small number. So most of your spins are randomly distributed between 1 and up and down. There's a small excess, in fact, one part in 100,000 of excess of up compared to down. And we assume here up is the lower energy state. And it turns out that this is sufficient to do quantum computing, or some quantum computing. And the reason is that although the state is very mixed, the decoherence time is quite long. and I'm just going to mention it, and we'll get back to this a little bit, is that, but before I go there, I should bring what is this omega here. So if you have a small magnet, and let's assume right now, and I'll show you how you do this, your magnetic moment of the hydrogen atom is pointing in the x or the y direction. And then you have this big field in the z direction. What happens to the magnetic moment? Well, this is supposed to be your high school physics that I'm trying to make you remember. So what happens? That's it. There's a torque in the third direction. A torque in the third direction makes the little magnet to turn a little bit, but it's still perpendicular, so it rotates. And it rotates at the frequency which is called the Larmor frequency. And this is what this omega here is 2 pi is the Larmor frequency. For the hydrogen in a field which is 10 to 15 Tesla, this corresponds to about 500 megahertz. So 500 megahertz is, if you know your electromagnetic spectrum, is FM radio. So it's everywhere. Wavelength are a fraction of a meter. So it's quite large without this. And now that you should be puzzled of how with a wavelength which is that long, you act on molecules which are separated by nanometers. And the answer to this is that we won't talk to these atoms in spatial modes, but we'll talk to them in the frequency modes. It turns out that I gave you the magnetic moment for the hydrogen. Okay? The magnetic moment for the carbon is about a quarter of the magnetic moment of the carbon. So if we have only 2 of these qubits, then their frequency is quite different from each other, so you can talk to each other in that frequency space. So what happens if you have 2 carbons? So there, you want to find a molecule which has some asymmetry in it. So suppose that I would, instead of having a carbon here, have a chlorine again. These 2 would be totally symmetric, and we would have no way to distinguish them. They might be good for some kind of experiments, but not if you want to identify them in different qubits. When you have an hydrogen here, it turns out that there's an electronic cloud that goes around in here, and it pulls the electrons in a slightly different way here than it does here. So this sees a slightly different electronic cloud than this one. The electronic cloud also has a magnetic moment, and it shields this one compared to this one slightly differently. So there's a difference in the magnetic moments of this one to this one, or the Larmor frequency. Okay? So the Larmor frequency of the carbon 1 is equal to the Larmor frequency of the carbon 2 plus something which is we call delta, or chemical shift. So the chemistry shift the Larmor frequency because it gets shielded in a different way from this field, and we use this. Okay. I mentioned that, so now you understand a little bit. We have these molecules. We choose them so that there's a decent chemical shift. We can talk to each other. There's a time scale, which we'll come back on, of decoherence that we mentioned. I'll come back to this in a minute. I'm just going to give the time scale to give you an idea that the frequencies that we're talking about are about hundreds of megahertz. Okay? The time of decoherence is about 1 second. And there's also a relaxation time, and we'll get back to what they are in a few minutes, about 30 seconds. So there's a separation of scale here. There's also a couple of other scales that we should bring it. Oh, delta. What is the size of delta? The size of delta is kilohertz. Okay, and kilohertz tells you that if you want to talk to one of them without talking to the other, because of the Fourier transform in space and time, you'll have to do gates about in time scale of about a millisecond. Okay, the decoherence time is about 1 second. So if you do a gate in 1 millisecond, you can do about 1,000 of them, and then T2 is going to kill you. Yeah? So for very small processors, this is pretty good if you can do 1,000 gates. If you want to scale up, then you'll have to do error correction in there. And maybe at the end completely, I'll bring some of this idea of how we do this. OK, so this gives you an idea of the setup of the system. I mentioned the initial state here. And one quantity that I'll come back again at the end is what we call the polarization, which is the trace of rho times the Z operator for each qubit. OK? And you remember that if you take the trace of rho and 1, and this is what the qubit is, trace of Z is equal to trace of Z, the operator 1 minus 1 in the diagonal. You take the trace, 0. Trace of Z times Z, then you have 1, 1. So the polarization is equal to this coefficient that you have in front. And we'll come back. And this polarization, as I mentioned, is roughly of the order of 10 to the minus 5 for liquid state NMR at room temperature. OK, questions? OK, so the qubits are this, are these systems, these magnetic moment. We've talked a little bit about the initial state. Now I'm going to go and talk to you a little bit about the measurement. And in order to have a measurement, we need to have a measurement apparatus. So what we're going to do is that we're going to put a coil here. And the coil will face in the x direction in the lab. Okay? In a few minutes, I'll tell you how to manipulate the spins. Now, just think it's an act of the person upstairs who magically kind of does this. In thermal equilibrium, they're going to kind of relax in direction up or down. But suppose it is in the x direction, as we said a few minutes ago, they're going to rotate. Okay? If you put a coil, okay, which is in this direction, and you're rotating around the z-axis, you're going to induce a current in that coil. And then you can go and measure that current. And what you get is that the current, as a function of time, you'll get some oscillation, and you're going to get damped. Okay. So these things, these oscillations, are called Ruby oscillation. They're just a rotation of this qubit in the xy plane. Okay? Then you can do a Fourier transform of this. So if you do a Fourier transform of the current as a function of the frequency, then you'll get a peak. Okay? And the peak is at the Larmor frequency of, let's say, this proton. Or if we look at the two carbons, okay, of carbon 1, of carbon 2. Okay, so each of them have their different frequency. The distance, one thing I forgot to mention to you is that the magnetic moment of the carbon is about a quarter of the size of a proton. So really, here, I should have put this in the other way around. The frequency of the carbon should be on the left, or I've done the bad thing of having the frequency decreasing on the right. Okay, so this should be really be there, and this one should be there, but I'm not going to write on it. So the distance between this and this turns out to be very large in the scale that we want, because it's hundreds of megahertz, which means nanoseconds to make a pulse here, which would not affect there. But in here, we'll have this come in. In a second, I'll come back to this. These peaks have a width. And the width is related to the decoherence time. And this decoherence time is related to how fast these things get damped. So as the spin rotates, and here's the classical picture of this, the spin rotates in this direction, noise is going to come and affects it. And the off-diagonal terms of the density matrix are going to shrink. And this is the phase decoherence, how much phase gets randomized as you evolve. Okay. Sources of these decoherence are these chlorine, for example. One thing that I did not mention is I told you that we have a little sample, and I should have brought an example of this, but I didn't. But the size of a sample is about the size of a pencil. So you have a few millimeters. So it's about that size. Kind of, what's the word in English? In French, it's éprouvette. No, the glass tube that. So you know the French. It's a glass tube, which is about that size. In French, it's éprouvette. And what is it in English? He's laughing at my French. That's it. We show that perimeter is bilingual. So we put this molecule in there, and then we put it in a solvent. And we put it in the solvent to be sure that the molecules, let's say our trichloroethylene or chloroform, are quite far from each other so that they interact weakly. If they're really near each other, there'll be some interaction between the two, which will lead to decoherence. Yeah. It turns out that the current, which is induced by one nuclear spin, is tiny. It's very, very, very small. So if there would be only one single spin in there, the typical NMR spectrometers would not see anything. And then to see something, we need quite a lot. So if you look at how many molecules there is when we have about this amount of this sample or this liquid in there, it's about 10 to 20 molecules. We have a polarization which is 10 minus 5. So it means that there's about 10 to the 15 spins, which let's say are pointing up, nuclear spins, proton spin, and this is what we can detect. Okay? If there would be much less than this, in fact, we can go down to about 10 to the 12, 10 to the 11, and still see something, but then we have to be more patient and be a lot more careful. So we have a lot of these molecules in there. Okay? Now, all these molecules are moving randomly. They don't talk to each other. In fact, when we do the quantum computation, we don't need more than one. It's only when we measure it at the end of computation that we need a lot of them doing things together. So that's why this implementation is called an ensemble implementation. It's because we need many of these molecules to make the measurement at the end and see something. Okay. So the measurement that we do, this current that we measure, is really the trace of rho as a function of time of sigma plus for the spin that you want. And if you have many spins, it'll be sigma plus 1, sigma plus 2, where sigma plus is x plus iy. Okay. And then knowing that the Hamiltonian of is this form, you see that, and let's say that we started not in the z, but in the x direction, we get that rho of t is equal to e to the I t omega z1 And if you go and calculate this, then you'll see that what you see as a current is something which indeed oscillates. Okay. When you have a second qubit, you add the piece of the different qubits. In a few seconds, we'll kind of find out what happens when we make them interact. Okay. The next piece I want to do is look at what happens when we have gates. How do we do gates?
is M? M of T?
It's proportional to the current. The current that goes into the coil of what you're observing.
How exactly do you make that work given that single plus not emission?
Good. There's really a complex conjugate of it. So the interaction comes from one photon which is emitted from the spin, which goes from one direction to the other,
right,
and gets absorbed by the coil. Okay, if there should be a sigma minus of the coil emitting one photon absorbed by the spin, but we start with the coil with no photons in it, so I neglected that part. Because that part gives you zero, and then you observe this. Okay, that was a very good comment. In fact, when I wrote sigma plus there, most of the time I will say that the observable are X or Y, and you can see both of them. In fact, when you Fourier transform, you'll have a real and imaginary part, and by picking out the real part of the Fourier transform, you're really measuring X, and the imaginary part will give you Y. And this type of measurement is really a weak measurement, and you might have seen this in Foundations of Quantum Mechanics. So this is a physical implementation. This is not a projective measurement that you have in other places. Initially, when people learn about NMR and the field of quantum information, they thought the fact that we don't have a projective measurement would stop you doing many things. For example, quantum error correction. Turns out that it doesn't matter. You can always find a way to do your quantum computation with that weak measurement. So let's do kind of the next part is gates. I told you that when the coil is not doing anything, you can observe the state of the system. So any suggestion of what would you do to be able to manipulate this quantum system? That's it. You do the reverse of what you do in measurement. So we're going to take this coil. We're going to send a pulse, okay, at a second frequency, which depends on if you want to talk to the carbon 1, carbon 2, or the hydrogen. Okay. You're going to send a pulse in that coil. And then you will see that it induces a unitary transformation, which will have that form. So up there, I assume that the magnetic field was B0 in the Z direction. Okay. And now what we're going to do is add a term. And the NMR people, for some reason, call the next term, which is B1, which is dependent on time. Okay. And the time dependence will be something like an amplitude, B1, which multiply cos of omega t plus phi of x plus sine of omega t plus phi of y. Okay. So by choosing a phase phi, you can decide if you do rotation around the x or the y axis. By choosing your initial time, you kind of do this. So you send a pulse, and the first thought that you have is you're going to do a pulse. B1 is 0. And at that time t1, you send something. At time t2, you stop. And this is going to induce rotation. So now this is the Larmor frequency. So we're going to send something with the Larmor frequency which corresponds to those. And we're going to go in the rotating frame. So the frame which rotates at the Larmor frequency for each of the qubits. Okay? So if you do this, then the unitary transformation which is induced looks like e to the minus I, the integral of dt of b1, a cos of phi of x plus sine of phi of y. So that time dependence disappears when you are in the rotating frame, And then suddenly you can start to look at this and you say, oh, this looks like a rotation around. And the rocks here. There's an angle phi in the plane, okay? And depending what is the strength of B1, so if you have, let's assume that it is indeed a square pulse like this, you're gonna do this integral, pretty easy to do. So you get B1 of T2 minus T1, or this delta T. So this will give you an angle, which is and there's a mu that I forgot there. And h bar is equal to 1. So mu times this gives you an angle of the rotation around there. So let's call the, you could call this theta. Okay? So we can, by choosing what is the values of phi, the amplitude of the field, the time t, you can do a rotation around anywhere on that plane. Okay? So you can do a rotation around x, you can do a rotation around y. I think in one of the exercises, you've learned that if you can do a rotation around x and y around any angle, you can do a rotation around z by combining the two. Have you seen this? Do you know how to do this?
But either way, we don't really need to do rotations around z. We just need to wait.
You know too much. The answer is yes. So I was going to say this a little bit. You can do your rotation around the z by, instead of doing a rotation around, suppose you want to do a rotation around y, okay? You change a reference frame that you track the qubit of, and then you just do that rotation at a slightly different time, and that implement the z rotation. And this is really good because typically the timing that you need to take over is much more precise than the pulses that we do to do these rotations. Which makes me think of one note that I didn't mention here, timing. So I told you T2 is about a second. The frequency is about 500 megahertz. If you turn this around, it tells you that the nuclear spin is turning around every nanosecond, roughly. And you do this for a second. So you do a billion turns. Okay? And what happens if instead at the end, instead of getting the state 0 plus 1, you would get a state 0 minus 1? How good would be your quantum computation? You get a state which is orthogonal to your answer. Instead of getting a 0, you get a 1 in that basis. Remember, this is plus. I use that because we're on the xy plane. This is the natural state. So suppose they're getting a plus, you get a minus. Would you care? Well, you better say yes because in your the way we'll score your homework, if you get anything a plus, we'll get a minus, you wouldn't be happy. So this tells you that the spectrometer has to be incredibly precise. It has to be precise much more. It has to keep the time much more precise than the nanosecond time frame. Because if it cannot keep that time, then you'll get wrong answer when you make these pulses, as you mentioned, or you change your reference frame. Yeah. OK, so by sending pulses in that coil, then you can start making rotation around xy. You can use the trick of changing the reference frame. And in fact, when we do quantum computation, we tag a reference frame to each of the nuclei. Each of them have their own reference frame. And you can do this classically. And you know, OK, this is the reference frame for carbon 1. This is a different reference frame for carbon 2. And then as you do z rotation on each of them, instead of doing them physically by doing x and y rotation, you just change that reference frame. OK, so we know how to do one qubit gate. But there's limitation of how fast we can do this. Here I told you that you do a square pulse. But if you go and do the Fourier transform of this, you'll see that it's sine of x over x. This is the Fourier transform of this. So when you look at this, then you get pulses that go there, and if you put frequency which going to affect this, then you're affecting the second qubit when you try to affect this one. So we usually don't do square pulses. First, the generators of the pulses, they don't like to do the delta function. So they usually, in fact, never do. You get something like which oscillate goes up, that looks about constant, and then go down like this when you try to do this. And this extra frequency that comes in affects your other qubit. So sometimes it's much better to have something which looks like a Gaussian with the same integral of this so that you get the right amount here so that you get, let's say, a pi over 2 rotation. Okay? So, and if you do a Gaussian in time or in frequency, you want to be sure that the Gaussian affects this, like this, but not that one. And this tells you a limit in which you can do a pulse without affecting dough by looking at the difference of a frequency or the chemical shift. I told you the difference of chemical shift about 1 kilohertz, and that tells you the limit that you cannot do pulses which are faster than 1 millisecond. Okay? Which this is why we cannot do things more than 1,000 gates.
Question. In order to induce this B1 field, you have components in X and Y. I mean, you need 2 coils.
In fact, I should have here put only X in the lab frame. But when you go in the rotating frame, X and Y comes in of the rotating frame. So, good one. So you use only 1 coil. You use 1 coil, and you use different time at which you pulse. And as you mentioned, this will give you an X or a Y rotation. OK, so we can do 1-qubit gate. We see the limitation of it. So how do we do 2-qubit gates? OK. We have 2 magnetic moments. They're like the little magnets on your fridge. And you know that if you try to put the magnet the same way around, although there's an interaction. And so this is the dipole-dipole interaction between these magnets. So your first trial is to say, oh, we're going to use a dipole-dipole interaction. Turns out that if you have a molecule in a liquid and then you let it go, it is going to tumble incredibly fast. It rotates around and kind of gets scrambled like this. And if you look at the dipole-dipole interaction between 2 atoms, okay, with this vector here, which is constant and like because you're in a molecule, but rotates very fast, the dipole-dipole interaction averages to 0. Okay? So just take 2 dipoles and assume that this one rotates on the sphere. You don't get anything. So in fact, it doesn't, like in life, things don't average exactly to 0. There's a little bit left. And this turns out to lead to some decoherence. Okay? There's a really neat effect. If indeed the T2 is related to this dipole-dipole interaction, which has not been averaged to 0 completely, there's a funny experiment you can do. You can heat up your sample. Most people will tell you that if you heat up your sample, you're going to decohere more. But here, you're going to make your molecule tumble a bit faster if you increase the temperature. And you see the T2 becomes longer, there's a little bit less decoherence. Doesn't work for all molecules, but you can see it for that. And that's a really neat thing. So when you think about decoherence, you should really think about your mechanism. And this is what tells you if increasing the temperature or not. But there's a different interaction, fortunately, called the J coupling, or indirect interaction. It's indirect because it comes from, let's say that we have an hydrogen and a carbon. There's an electron cloud in this molecule that goes around. And depending if the nuclear spins are pointing in the same direction or opposite, it affects the energy of this electron. And so there's an interaction which is induced between these two through the electron And this doesn't get averaged away when the molecule tumbles. And this is what leads to this J-coupling interaction. So, and if you go and work out the details of this, which turns out to be quite complex, then it leads to an interaction which looks like this, pi j over 2 of x1, x2, plus y1, y2, plus z1, z2, between two nuclear spins. You might say the electron is going to lead to decoherence. But it doesn't if it doesn't get excited. That is, the electron doesn't get on the superposition of zeros and one. It's just its energy changes as the behavior of this is different. So it leads to a coherent interaction. It has this form. Now there's an interesting property. If the chemical shift is much greater than pi j over 2, you can see that some of these terms are going to go to 0. And here's the way that you can see this. Suppose that indeed you have this equation here. And you're looking at this Hamiltonian of interaction, okay, in the reference frame of this first spin. This operator is going to rotate at this frequency, the chemical shift. So x2, view from the first one, is going to rotate because they don't have the same frequency. There's a difference between the two. X1 is going to rotate to y2. Sorry, x2 is going to rotate to y2 minus x2 minus y2, go back to 2. So this is going to go to y2 minus x2 and then minus y2. And if this happens fast enough, this turn average to 0. Okay? It's related to these off-resonance effects. If you don't push the swing of a balance enough, then things don't work. Here is that this thing is going so fast that way. So this goes to 0. Same thing, argument goes there. So we're left with this. And then with those things, then we get an Hamiltonian. We can think about this in this way. There's a very neat interpretation of what this interaction is like. Okay? Look at this Hamiltonian here. And right now, focus on understanding of what is the impact on this one. Assume that Z2 is in the state 0. 0 is an eigenstate of Z2, or I should say carbon 2 is in the state 0. 0 for that state here is an eigenstate of Z2 with eigenvalue 1. So this is 1. So then for C1, it looks like it has an Hamiltonian omega 1 plus pi 2 over J Z1. It changes the frequency by pi J over 2. It makes it spin a little faster. And if C2 is in the state 1, then the state 1 is an eigenstate of Z2 with eigenvalue minus 1. So we have this. Oh. Okay. So now we go back and see, put your spin in this magnet. Put it in the x direction by sending a pulse like this. Stop sending pulses. Look what happens in your coil. And then you'll realize that if you go and do the same calculation as what we have, somebody's been playing hockey. Do the similar calculation here. Instead of having the free Hamiltonian, we have this one with a Z1 term. What you will see as the Fourier transform of the current, you add one peak when it was free, it will be divided in two. Okay, and the distance between these two is pi over 2j. And it turns out that this peak corresponds to C2 being in the state 0, and this peak correspond to C2 being in state 1. Okay? Good. Now, what happened if C1 interacts with the third spin? And as a J coupling, let's call this one J12. Suppose that there's a J13. What would you see? That's it. Each of those will be split again. Okay. So when we have a molecule like this one, it turns out that the J coupling of things which are nearby is stronger. And then when you're a little bit further, then you see a smaller splitting. So I'm going to play this. Okay. Number two. I'm going to continue here. If you have three of them, okay, so the difference between this and this will be related to pi over 2, J13. Same thing for this, and the distance between here will be pi, J12. So this ZZ interaction is the way which we do two-qubit gate, and I think you have an exercise to show how do you change, how do you build a control knot. So if you're happy with control knots, how do you build a control knot with a ZZ interaction? So you can see that it is a control gate, because depending on the second qubit being in 0 and 1, it does a Z rotation. So you want to transfer that one, and it do a plus and a minus rotation. In the control knot, you do nothing on the first qubit, and you do it only when you have a 1 and 0. So you have to change the gate a little bit and adjust it. You'll see how it works. OK. Now, here's a funny thing. The Hamiltonian Z1, Z2 is there all the time, right? There are devices when we want to have your qubit. You remember with the photons didn't talk to each other at any time. Anyways, I was going to use a swear word. I won't, as I'm being recorded. It's very hard for the photons to make them interact with each other. Here, they interact all the time. So turns out what is hard in an MR is having them do nothing. You let them, they do something. So you have to pull them apart in some way. How do we stop them to interact? And this is called refocusing. Okay? So I'm going to go in a rotating frame of both qubits. So I'm going to forget the omega 1, omega 2, and just look at the interaction. And what I want to do is to make a unitary a sequence of gates. Think about it as a small quantum computation. Your first quantum computation with an MR is to do nothing. So, and if you succeed, then you get the star for your homework. So you want to do nothing. So you have your two qubits, the interaction is on, and then you want, on average here, to do a unitary, which is unit. So what you do is that you split it in two, okay? And then you do an X rotation by 180 degree in the middle, and at the end you do the X rotation 180. So what is the evolution here and here? So if this is time t, this one is time over 2, and here's how it works. You have, for the first, time over 2, j pi over 2. I'm going to call this delta so I don't have to carry all these numbers, z1, z2. Okay. Here I do minus x pi over 2 x. And then I do the same thing here, e to the minus I delta z1, z2. And I do the last piece here. Okay. So you understand the different parts. Now you you've learned how to expand this in polynomials, right? So this is cos of delta 1 minus I sine delta z1, z2. Now you have to remember you can do this as long as this operator square to 1. Okay? And it does. If it wouldn't be this, I couldn't write it that way, but magically things have worked very well. This thing here is x. And here we have cos of delta 1 minus I sine delta z1, z2. Okay? And now what I want is, I'm going to use these two terms. I want to pull this here. I have to use the commutation relation. Because this is unit, it's easy. So I can rewrite this as x, and this one here, remember there's an x. So there's x cos delta, and the unit operator. This one doesn't work as well, or you need to know. So I want to know, can we relate this to this? And what do we have to do the equality? Remember the power? So the z2 is no problem because it commutes with x1. But how does that work? Xz is equal to
minus.
Right? That's it. There's a minus. Okay? So there's a minus here. Okay? So if you do one or the other, if you don't know this, spend 30 seconds at lunch, write it down, and you'll see. Because we'll use this again when we do error correction. So if I pull this here, it's plus I sinus delta z1, z2. The 2x cancel. This one is a plus. So I can write it back this way with a plus here. And the plus is going to cancel that. So there, you've made your unit operation. So the trick is really to put a pulse in the middle. It refocuses. And there's a physics way of doing. So what does this interaction tell you? Then it tells you that when you look at your spin, you'll get into a superposition of a piece going to the left, piece going to the right, depending on the other spin going on 0 and 1. And so you let them go, and that's how they interact, the conditional interaction. But halfway through, you do the x rotation. So you flip them like this. And then they keep on the right way, but the one which was slow becomes at the faster place, and the place which was fast goes, and then it comes back. So the trick is to do exactly in the middle, and then you're done. And this is how you do nothing in NMR. I can stop here, or if I use 3 more minutes, you guys are not going to starve. Start to throw me something when you're too hungry. How do we do this for many qubits? So we can do this. So here I have qubit 1, qubit 2, qubit 3. Where are we focusing on one? I should have mentioned, I added a pulse here, okay, at the end so that it cancels with this. But this is really flipping all the bits. And you can absorb this in everything else. It's a change of reference frame. So really, when you do it in practice, you try to do as little pulse as possible so we forget this one. But you can add them here if you want. But right now, I'm not. Suppose that you have these coupling two with a third qubit. If you do this, okay, you will stop the coupling with that one. But these ones, it won't work because you will have here not x1, but x1, x2. And this is an anti-commute. So you have to be smarter. And by playing around a little bit, you say, oh, if I do it here and here. So This one is at time t over 2. This one would be time t over 4. Time t over 4, it would work. Now, if you have a fourth one, then you will say, OK, I do it here, 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 here. So the t over 8, and then t over 8 plus t over 4, and then etc. And then you will see that this, you would bring all this easy coupling down to with all of this. Now, the problem is this, is that I've gone from 1 to 2 to 4. How many I will need on the next one? 8. And is that good? It's not. This would not be scalable. So if you have only a few, OK, go and do it. Be my guest. But you cannot think about this. So there's a way of doing this. There are a family of matrices, which are called Adamar matrices. So for 2 qubits, what does the Adamar matrix look like? Right? There's a family of Adamar matrices, which are generalized from this. So you want, except for the first row and column, which will add, all the other ones have to add to 0. So here, if you add the 0, we add this 0. OK? You can think about this piece as we're going in the right way to add the ZZ coupling, and suddenly we flipped it, so it becomes a minus. That was this part here. There's an Adamar matrix, which is 4 by 4, which looks like plus, 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 minus, plus, minus, plus, plus, minus, minus, plus, minus, minus, plus. OK? And this tells you where you're, when you switch from plus to minus, it's where you're going to put one of these poles. And because there's equivalent number of plus and minus, it will cancel all these interactions. And then you can do it in that way. So this is the right way of canceling. OK. So we've done nothing with our NMR spectrometer, and we're really proud of it. So I'm going to stop there. And what I'll do tomorrow is that I'll get back to the initial state. OK? I told you, yes, you can start with this one half of epsilon z. You can do something. But these are not really zero states, right, if you want to do a quantum computation. So the first thing I'll tell you is that sometimes you might not want to have a zero state. Maybe mixed state, you can do something interesting. I'll give you a small algorithm where you can do something really interesting, well, from a quantum information point of view, where the state is incredibly mixed. And it turns out where there's very, very little entanglement. You can still do something which is very hard to do classically. Or maybe I should say where we don't know how to do this efficiently classically. And if you can find a trick of how to do this algorithm classically efficiently, then stop for a few weeks of being a student in physics, go and work for an NMR spectrometer company, and you'll get a lot of money because they don't know how to do this. So we don't know how to do this efficiently, but it's a very mixed state algorithm. It works because we do unitary transformation, but on a mixed state. Okay? And then I'll tell you about something called pseudo-pure state. Okay? I'll do this, which how people started to think about how to do quantum computing with NMR. And I'll finish with something called algorithmic cooling. Pseudo-pure state might work, but if you want to do error correction, we don't know how to do this without pure state. I'll show you how to do this, and then I'll finish there with algorithmic cooling. And then I'll have a few slides. I'll make a few comments about other implementation, like ion traps or superconducting qubits. I'll be very brief. I won't go through all details. But at least for your culture, that you cannot get out of here and have no idea of what a superconducting qubit is. In fact, I have one superconducting qubit in my bag, and then you can have a look at what it looks like. And then I'll have a plot with a few things about experiments. So it'll give you an idea of where are we in the world of doing quantum computation. OK? So I'll stop there.